The topic that we agreed on, driving forces in foreign policy, is quite large. I obviously can only hope to provide a few hints as to how I think it can be productively examined and why we should do so, why it's imperative to do so. I'll keep to the U.S. for several reasons, though the observations, I think, generalize. One reason is it's plainly the most important case in the contemporary world. A second reason is that the United States is an unusually open society, I think actually uniquely so. So it turns out we know quite a lot about the driving forces that we can only surmise elsewhere. And thirdly is the obvious reason that it's the most important case for us. It's the one case in which we share responsibility for policy and can significantly hope to influence it. Well, there is a kind of received standard version. It's common to academic scholarship, diplomacy, public discourse. I'll just quote a few leading figures to illustrate, but it's quite general. So take, say, George Kennan, one of the founders of the structure of the modern world. According to him, government is created to assure order and justice internally and to provide for the common defense. Current issue of the journal National Interest, a leading realist scholar, John Mearsheimer, formulates the doctrine in these words: the structure of the international system forces countries concerned about their security to compete with each other for power. A leading scholar of U.S. Middle East policy, William Quant, also has long diplomatic experience, writes that the driving force of U.S. policy is to ensure the security and the well-being of the population of the United States, and so on. And all agree that the primary concern since 1945 has been the Russian threat. There are a number of ways to evaluate the doctrine. So one obvious question to ask is, what happened when the Russian threat disappeared in 1989? There's an answer. Everything remained the same. I'll give a few examples. Immediately after the fall of the Berlin Wall, the United States invaded Panama, killed probably thousands of people, installed a mostly poor, installed a client regime. That's routine practice in U.S. domains, but in this case it was not quite routine, because for the first time it was not justified by an alleged Russian threat. That would have been impossible. Rather, a series of fraudulent pretexts were concocted that collapse instantly on examination. I've reviewed them elsewhere, won't go through it. The media were chimed in enthusiastically, lauding the heroic achievement, unconcerned that the pretexts were ludicrous, that it was a radical violation of international law, and that it was bitterly condemned elsewhere, most harshly in Latin America. Also ignored was the U.S. veto of a unanimous Security Council resolution, Britain abstained, condemning crimes by U.S. troops during the invasion. All routine, all forgotten here, although not in Panama, which is also routine. Well, right afterwards, the Bush administration quite naturally released a new national security strategy adapted to the new circumstances with the Russians gone. Also a defense budget. Same purpose. It was pretty much the same as before, but with new pretexts. So, for example, we needed a huge military establishment, and not to protect ourselves from the Russians, they'd gone, but because of what was called the technological sophistication of third world powers. If you're a well-educated intellectual, you don't laugh when you hear that. It was also necessary, they said, to maintain what they called the defense industrial base. That's a euphemism for high-tech industry, which is based on extensive state intervention in the economy, in our so-called free market economy. With regard to the Middle East, it emphasized that we must maintain our major intervention forces directed at the Middle East, and then came an interesting phrase, where the primary threats to our security could not have been laid at the Kremlin's door. So, sorry folks, contrary to 50 years of deceit, we now have to concede that the main concern was not the Kremlin, but it was what's called radical nationalism, a term that refers to independent nationalism that is under U.S. control. All of this, incidentally, passed unnoticed, as you can easily determine, an interesting exercise for those who want to write a thesis and destroy their job opportunities. It all passed unnoticed, but it has some pretty evident bearing on the standard doctrine. Well, there were other important events that took place right after the fall of the Berlin Wall, ending the Cold War. One of them was actually a few days later in El Salvador. That was the leading recipient of U.S. military aid at the time, apart from Egypt and Israel, separate category. And it also had one of the worst human rights records anywhere, and that's a pretty standard correlation. The Salvadoran High Command ordered the Atlacatl Brigade to invade the Jesuit University, the major university, and to murder 6 leading Latin American intellectuals, Jesuit priests, also to murder any witnesses, meaning their housekeeper and their daughter. The brigade had just returned from advanced training in the John F. Kennedy Counterinsurgency School, North Carolina, and had already left, had a bloody record of thousands of victims, usual victims, poor, defenseless. And this was in the course of a U.S.-run terror campaign in El Salvador, part of a more general terror and torture campaign throughout the region. All routine, virtually no interest here, and almost no memory. Tells us a lot about the factors that drive policy, but it also tells us a lot about ourselves. Well, let's take another illustrative example, Cuba. This is 1989. For 40 years then, since Cuba gained independence in 1959, for 40 years the United States had subjected Cuba to a murderous terrorist attack, mostly during the Kennedy years, and a crushing embargo, all in defense against the Russians. Well, no Russians, so what happened? The attack on Cuba became harsher, considerably harsher. It was spearheaded by liberal Democrats. Actually, in the 1992 election, Clinton outflanked Bush from the right to increase the threat against Cuba now that the Russian pretext had gone. None of this would have come as a surprise to anyone who was paying attention to the internal record, to declassified documents. From the early 1960s, they made it clear that the threat of Cuba was what the State Department called its successful defiance of U.S. policies going back to the Monroe Doctrine in 1823. No Russians, but the intention to dominate the hemisphere. All passes without notable impact on the standard doctrine. Another important event took place in Europe at the very same time. Soviet President Mikhail Gorbachev made quite an astonishing concession. He agreed to allow Germany to be unified and to join a hostile military alliance, NATO. Just think about recent history and you can see how astonishing that was. There was, however, a quid pro quo. The U.S. government, President Bush, Secretary of State James Baker, agreed that NATO would not advance 1 inch to the east. That was the phrase. They meant East Germany. Instantly, they expanded NATO to East Germany. Gorbachev was outraged, naturally, and he complained But when he did, he was instructed by Washington that this was just a verbal agreement, a gentleman's agreement, and therefore it had no force. All routine, as was the silent acceptance and the approval here. Clinton came along right after, expanded NATO further to the east, right to the borders of Russia. Today, the world faces a serious crisis that is in no small measure a result of these policies, which also bear, in obvious ways, on the standard doctrine. Well, there's a good deal more than the placement that we're ended that's actually highly revealing, but I'll leave it at that and turn to other ways to evaluate the doctrine. One obvious source of information is declassified documents, which often are very revealing about the actual motives of state policy, like the case of Cuba, which I mentioned. There's no time to review the matter here, but it's worth mentioning a few persistent themes. We find consistently that one driving force in policy is concern about what Henry Kissinger called the viruses that might spread contagion. Kissinger was referring specifically to Allende's Chile, which threatened to spread the contagion of a peaceful parliamentary path towards independent development and social welfare. Well, we know the outcome in that case, and it's duplicated in case after case throughout Latin America, Southeast Asia, Africa, and the Middle East, right from the late 1940s right up to the present. Well, not much more, a lot more to say about that. I presume you're familiar with the cases, and should be. But I think the historical record demonstrates quite clearly that the standard doctrine has very little merit. Security, in the normal sense of the word, is by no means a prominent factor in policy formation. Well, at least in the normal sense of the term security. I stress the normal sense. In evaluating the standard doctrine that claims that we're dedicated to security, we have to ask a question that's rarely asked, namely, security for whom? It's worth taking a look. One answer is security for state power. There are many illustrations of that. Now, let me just take one current one in the last couple of days. The United States agreed, a little surprisingly, to support a UN Security Council resolution which is calling on the International Criminal Court to investigate war crimes in Syria. That's kind of unusual. The U.S. usually evades the ICC. But in this time it agreed, however, with a proviso, no inquiry would be permitted into possible war crimes by Israel or, of course, by the United States. That, again, is routine. The United States is uniquely self-immunized from the international legal system. It's a very interesting topic. No time to pursue it, but it illustrates the importance of protecting the security of state power. Another prime concern is security of state power from the domestic population, which is consistently regarded as a major enemy for good reasons. Government secrecy, for example, rarely has a genuine security motivation. You can find that out by investigating the cases. But it definitely does serve to keep the population in the dark, protecting state power from the people who shouldn't know about it. In sharp contrast to that, the population is not secure from state power. Actually, a striking current illustration of that is President Obama's radical attack on the Fourth Amendment. You're all familiar with that, the extraordinary surveillance campaign, which on any reading of the Fourth Amendment, except by the courts, is a radical violation of it. Just look at the wording. It's justified, of course, by security, but that's normal. Every act of every state is reflexively justified by security. There was, when it was exposed, the Snowden revelations, when they began to be exposed, the government claimed that the NSA, huge, massive NSA system, had prevented 54 terrorist attacks. It's pretty significant. Gradually it was whittled down. And finally there was a government commission, high-level government commission, initiated by Congress, which had access to classified sources and so on, and they investigated, and they did find one case. Somebody had sent $8,000 to Somalia. That's what the yield of this massive system of picking up all your phone calls and Facebook postings and so on. Not too unusual. Another driving concern of foreign policy is security of private power. Many illustrations, take a couple current ones. There's two huge trade agreements being negotiated, trans-Pacific, trans-Atlantic, enormous trade agreements. They're secret from the population. They're not completely secret. They're not secret from the hundreds of corporate lawyers and lobbyists who are writing them in detail. And you can make a guess as to what that's going to look like. Actually, you don't have to make a complete guess. There was one leak from WikiLeaks. It was about the section that deals with what's called intellectual property. That's a term of art which refers to guarantees of ridiculously high profits for pharmaceutical corporations, media corporations, and so on, guaranteeing them monopoly pricing rights for long periods, and of course raising prices of drugs and so on. That's intellectual property, and that's got to be secured. That part leaked, but yes, well, there are other examples, plenty of them, too numerous to mention, and they aren't surprising. Plenty of academic literature on this, in fact. Here's one just released from Princeton University by two leading political scientists who've studied this for a long time, Martin Gillens, Benjamin Page. They point out that this extensive study, quote, indicates that economic elites and organized groups representing business interests have substantial independent impacts on U.S. government policy, while average citizens and mass-based interest groups have little or no independent influence. The results provide substantial support for theories of economic elite domination, but not for theories of majoritarian electoral democracy or majoritarian pluralism. That's actually a very old story. Martin Gillens, one of the authors, has studied this for a long time. His work shows very convincingly that about 70% of the population, lower 70% on the income scale, are essentially disenfranchised. That is, the government pays absolutely no attention to their attitudes. Influence increases slowly as you move up, and at the very top, essentially, they make policy. Tom Ferguson over at UMass is the leading scholar of the effect of campaign contributions on policy. It goes back over a century, and it's a very striking impact right to the present. So that ought to be familiar. In fact, it's so familiar that it really ought to be taught in elementary school. And it tells you quite a lot about the driving forces in policy. So in general, there's ample evidence that security of state power, including security from the dangerous population, and security of concentrated economic power, private power, those are driving forces in policy formation. And furthermore, that's entirely natural and to be expected when you look into how policy is formulated, who has a role in formulating it. It's not quite that simple. There's some interesting cases, actually some current ones, where these commitments conflict. I could talk about them if you like. But this is quite a good first approximation and radically opposed to the standard doctrine. Well, let me turn to another question. What about security of the population? That's the normal sense of security. It's easy to demonstrate that this is a very marginal concern of policy planners. Now, let me just take two current examples to illustrate, major examples. One is global warming. the other's nuclear weapons. These are pretty severe threats, something new in human history. Those are threats to survival. And there's an obvious security interest, so how is it dealt with? Well, any literate person ought to be aware that these really are dire threats to the security of the population. If you happen to read this morning's newspaper, you'll notice that a lead story just carries the significance of the threat several notches higher, quite serious. But that should be familiar. Well, what about state policy? It's committed to accelerating the threat in both cases, global warming and nuclear weapons, in the interest of the primary concerns, state power and concentrated private power, which largely determines state policy. So, for example, take global warming. There's a lot of exuberance in the United States now, it's all over the press and journals, about what's called 100 years of energy independence as we become the Saudi Arabia of the 21st century, possibly the final century of human civilization if current policies persist. So take President Obama. He orated about the matter with his usual eloquence. He proclaimed with pride to ample applause, quote him now, that now under my administration, America is producing more oil today than at any time in the last 8 years, it was 2 years ago. That's important to know. Over the last 3 years, I've directed my administration to open up millions of acres for gas and oil exploration across 23 different states. We're opening up more than 75% of our potential oil resources offshore. We've quadrupled the number of operating rigs to a record high. We've added enough new oil and gas pipelines to encircle the earth, and then some. Great applause, which also tells us something about the government commitment to security. Now, this talk happened to be given in Cushing, Oklahoma, which is an oil town, as he announced. And in fact, it's the oil town. It's the most significant trading hub for crude oil in North America. And industry profits are sure to be secured as, quote, the president, producing more oil and gas here at home will continue to be a critical part of energy strategy, as it will. That illustrates very clearly the concern for security. And certainly not for the population, not for your grandchildren, quite the opposite. And it also illustrates very clearly the moral calculus of contemporary state capitalism, its Anglo-American version. The fate of your grandchildren counts as essentially nothing as compared with the need for profits in the next quarter. That's the fundamental moral calculus. And the conclusions are fortified by a look at the propaganda system. There's a huge public relations campaign. It's completely public, announced, nothing secret about it. It's organized by the business world, by major sectors of the business world, to try to convince the public that global warming either is unreal, or if it is correct, has nothing to do with human activity. And it's having some impact. A couple of weeks ago, there were some international polls published on attitudes towards global warming. It's very high in most countries. The U.S. ranks lower than other countries in public concern about global warming. And the results are interestingly stratified. So among Democrats, the U.S. ranks somewhat lower than other countries. Among Republicans, it's way down at the bottom. Almost none. And that's the party that is most religiously dedicated to the needs of private wealth and power. Again, tells you something about security. Well, there is a the current, there's a the leading journal of media analysis and criticism, Columbia Journalism Review. Its current issue has an interesting article about this topic. it attributes this outcome to what it calls the media doctrine of fair and balanced, meaning if a journal publishes an opinion piece reflecting the conclusion of 97% of scientists, it has to run a piece alongside it by the Heartland Institute, which expresses the views of the energy corporations. That's the way to be fair and balanced and objective. And that, indeed, is what happens. But there certainly is no doctrine of fair and balance. So, for example, suppose a journal runs an opinion piece denouncing Putin for the criminal act of taking over Crimea. Well, it surely does not have to run a piece pointing out that while this act is indeed a criminal act, Russia has a far stronger case than the U.S. does in taking over southeastern Cuba over a century ago and holding on to it, rejecting the demand of Cuba for giving it back to them after its independence. And here the only justification is that this contributes to the 50-year program of terrorist war and economic strangulation of Cuba. Far worse than Putin's taking over of Crimea, where there's all kinds of reasons. And the same is actually true of quite a few other current cases. But no need to run op-eds and columns on that. No fair and balanced in that case. There is an actual media doctrine of fair and balanced, namely where the concerns of private power are involved, not elsewhere. And though obvious enough, this just cannot be perceived in the elite culture. Well, a couple of weeks ago, the New York Times had an 8-page supplement on the new energy regime based on fracking and Canadian tar sands. It was mostly euphoric. Now, there were a couple of phrases about local environmental effects, like it might harm the water supply, but there was not a single word on what the world will look like if the U.S. exploits its vast fossil reserves. Security of our grandchildren is just not a concern of state policy or the information system. Well, let me turn to the other case, nuclear weapons. The record is actually extremely interesting, and I wish there were time to review it. I think it demonstrates, I've done it elsewhere, it demonstrates very clearly, I think, that from the earliest days, 1950, security of the population was just a non-issue and remains so to the present. No time to run here to run through the shocking record, but I think there's little doubt that it supports the lament of General Lee Butler. He was the last commander of the Strategic Air Command that's in charge of nuclear weapons. As he puts it, we've so far survived the nuclear age by some combination of skill, luck, and divine intervention, and I suspect the latter in greater proportion. And we can hardly count on continued divine intervention as policymakers continue to play roulette with the fate of the species in pursuit of the actual driving forces in policy formation. Well, as we're all surely aware, we now face the most ominous decisions in human history. There are lots of problems that should be addressed, and two are overwhelming in their significance: environmental destruction, nuclear war. For the first time in human history, we face the prospects of destroying the possibility for decent existence, and not in the distant future. For this reason alone, it's imperative, I think, to sweep away the ideological clouds and to face honestly and realistically the question of how policy decisions are made, and more significantly than that, what we can do to alter them before it's too late.